That's what I call the subjunctive aesthetics, right? This shift away from the indicative and the real, the what is, and toward the modes of hypothesis, of dreaming, of imagination, of doubting. Art has this capacity to ignite our imaginations and help us imagine the way the world could be otherwise, or how it should be.
You're listening to Speaking of Language, a podcast recorded at the Language Resource Center at Cornell University. Each week, we explore a topic related to language pedagogy and second language acquisition. This week, on Speaking of Language,
Carolyn Fornoff joins us to discuss her research into the intersection of art, artists, and climate change in Latin America, as investigated in her new book, Subjunctive Aesthetics.
Welcome to a new episode of Speaking of Language. I'm Angelica Kramer, the director of the Language Resource Center at Cornell University.
And I'm Sam Lupowitz, the LRC's media manager. We are joined today by Dr. Carolyn Fornoff from Cornell's Department of Romance Studies.
She recently published a book titled Subjunctive Aesthetics, Mexican Cultural Production in the Era of Climate Change, and she will share her findings with us on the podcast today.
Welcome to Speaking of Language, Carolyn.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here with both of you.
So before we dive into your book, can you tell us a little bit more about your own path with languages and your background here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from Austin, Texas. And growing up in Texas, there's a lot of contact with Mexican culture. But when I was 15, my dad had an opportunity to take a job in Boston. And I was really excited to move. And my parents were worried. They were like, why do you want to leave Texas? And, you know, I was bored with my life, with my friends. And so they suggested that I consider doing study abroad. And so I was 15. I had just finished my sophomore year of high school. And I had been studying Spanish as a middle schooler and high schooler. And so they introduced me to the idea of a high school year abroad. And I did a year abroad in Argentina through the program AFS. And my mom had wanted me to go to Spain, but I said, absolutely not. I picked the country that was the farthest away.
Of course,
so,
yes.
Argentina was where I ended up. And that year was the year 2001. And so it was a very eventful year. While I was in Argentina, the Twin Towers fell, as well as at the end of the year, the Argentine peso collapsed. There was an economic crisis.
Wow.
And so for me, it was a real year of political awakening because I suddenly started thinking about politics in a whole new way. And understanding anti-Americanism and the role of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. And so I think that ever since then, I've felt a deep connection between the Spanish language and sort of this moment of political and creative awakening for me and growth, you know, as a, as a 15-year-old.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Wow.
Well, so that leads us to your research, which is focused on cultural responses to the environmental crisis in Latin America. Could you talk a bit about what led you to this field of study and how did that culminate in your new book?
Yeah, of course. So after undergrad, I taught Spanish in Houston for 3 years to middle schoolers, most of whom were from Mexico and Central America, so working with heritage speakers. And after a couple of years of doing that, I decided that I would be a much better teacher of adults who were older. I was terrible at disciplining the middle schoolers. I wanted them to like me, which is not a great
age.
way to deal with middle schoolers. And so I went back to grad school. And at that time, Texas, as well as Mexico, was enduring one of the biggest droughts on the historical record. And it was affecting all sorts of people's livelihoods, and in response to that drought, many people were migrating, and yet the media didn't really seem to connect the dots between climate change and immigration. And so ever since that experience, I became increasingly interested in how environmental crisis shapes shapes our life, mm-hmm. And how it's not just a problem of the future, as we've often thought about climate change as sort of this future problem, but it's a problem of the present.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
it's a problem that we've been living and dealing with. And I became interested in thinking about how literature and the arts reckons with environmental crisis, mm-hmm. how it helps us see and understand environmental crisis in different ways. It brings stories of climate change mm-hmm. to us. Mm-hmm. It helps visualize climate change in interesting ways.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And you just mentioned that there are different contemporary filmmakers, writers, and visual artists, right? And you are looking at how they approach climate change.
Mm.
Can you summarize the changes in engagement that you have seen in your research?
Absolutely. So the book that I just published is an assessment of how Mexican filmmakers, writers, and visual artists have dealt with topics of environmental crisis in the 21st century. And what I found as I was surveying cultural production is that there's a real shift away from using art to prove or demonstrate evidence of environmental crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think about in the book as sort of these indicative modes mm-hmm. of narrating environmental crisis, showing us what is.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the if we think about the mode of the indicative as a grammatical mood, right, it's the mode of certainty, mm-hmm. of truth-telling, of statements, of fact. And so environmentalist art has often operated in this mode of certainty and trying to, make the case that we don't need, there's no ambiguity to this,
right?
That there is climate change that's happening and we all have to be on the exact same page. But what I saw in 21st century artistic engagement with environmental crisis was a shift away from this emphasis on art's evidentiary function or mode of truth-telling, and an embrace instead of art's ability to bask in uncertainty, in speculation, in possibility, in response to environmental change. And that's what I call the subjunctive aesthetics, right?
Got
this
it.
Shift away from the indicative and the real, the what is, and toward the modes of hypothesis, of dreaming, of imagination, of doubting. And so in the book, I talk about how art has this capacity to not just show us that environmental crisis is happening, but to ignite our imaginations and help us imagine the way the world could be otherwise or how it should be.
Yeah, that's great.
So talking about these different mediums of expression that you were investigating in your work, film, painting, poetry, what have you, I know you talk a bit about how the idea of subjunctive aesthetics unifies them. Do you also see any notable differences in the way various artists or art forms engage with the climate crisis?
Yes. So in each chapter, I look at a different sort of subjunctive strategy, and those strategies vary widely. And sometimes I map those strategies onto different forms of cultural expression. So, for example, in the first chapter, which is about environmental rewriting, I look at how the author and visual artist Veronica Guerra-Bisechi uses rewriting of canonical Mexican texts from the 20th century as a strategy to sort of project them into the future and imagine what those texts would be like if they had been written from the vantage of today. And so there are these works by writers like José Juan Tablada and Amparo Dávila in the 20th century that don't really register an environmental consciousness that Guerra-Bisechi sort of inhabits and dwells in these inherited textual infrastructures and makes sort of small modifications to then sort of amplify how those texts
right.
could speak also to environmental crisis. So that's just one of the subjunctive strategies is rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the last chapter, which is about greening Mexican cinema, I look at how filmmakers in Mexico are responding to the need to sort of think about cinema's carbon footprint and environmental footprint. And there, the filmmakers are often experimenting with what can be called like carbon neutral forms of filmmaking and film exhibition.
Hmm.
So they use sort of solar panels or even bike pedaling as a way to sort of generate alternate forms of energy that aren't dependent on oil.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. So you've touched on subjunctive aesthetics being about, quote, the planet not just as it is, but as it could be or should be, end quote. Are there any particularly notable visions of what could or should be that you came across in your research?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that there are several models of how we can imagine the world and culture otherwise. And so one of them, right, is this film exhibition infrastructure, right? So in rural Mexico, there are many places that do not have movie theaters. And so I look at this initiative called Cine Móvil Toto that brings cinema screenings to rural populations in Mexico, with sort of like pop-up film screenings. And the way they do these pop-up film screenings is totally totally carbon neutral by using solar panels and by bringing these bikes that sort of generate energy through children that attend the shows. And they enjoy pedaling the bikes to sort of power the projector and power the sound. And so that's sort of just one speculative model of how we can reimagine cultural infrastructure to speak to the problems of the present.
Interesting.
And your book focuses on Mexico in part because of its contradictions as a state that has positioned itself as a leader in combating climate change while also escalating its resource extraction. But what can that specific example teach us about other countries and their cultural responses?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, right, so Mexico has this contradiction, right, of being sort of at the forefront of conversations that are happening at the United Nations to combat climate change, but also at the same time doubling down on oil as a way to power the economy, as well as granting a lot of extractions to mining companies. But we could say that this contradiction is really a contradiction of the present in most countries throughout the world, including the United States. But I think that looking to Latin America, really often it foregrounds the role of colonialism in how it intersects with contemporary environmental crisis and the uneven way in which the people who produce the most emissions are often not the people who suffer from its effects.
What is a key takeaway for our listeners and the reader specifically of the book? Are there any actions that you hope your book will inspire? Any thoughts or wishes that you'd like to share with language instructors in particular?
I think that perhaps this goes beyond the book, but one of the most important takeaways is that climate change isn't just a scientific problem. And it's not just an economic problem, it's also a cultural problem. It's a problem of what stories we tell about our relationship with the planet. It's a problem that is derived from the values that we have and the way in which we relate to the non-human planet. And I think that language is a way through which we articulate our relationship and the way that we think about the non-human world. It's those stories and those values that shape the policies that we make and the way that we relate to the planet. And so I think then often looking to other places, right? Thinking with indigenous thinkers or with global South thinkers is ways of moving beyond sort of this model, this extractivist model of a utilitarian approach to the planet that's only value lies in its economic value, mm-hmm, and instead seeing the value of land and of territory as being sort of this life-giving force.
Yeah. Nice.
Great. Well, Carolyn, what other projects are you currently working on?
Well, this summer I'm going to be hosting a Nexus project, which is for undergraduate research at Cornell. And one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to look at the archives of Andrew Dixon White, who was was Cornell's first president and one of Cornell's co-founders. And an interesting fact about Andrew Dixon White is that he was charged by Ulysses Grant to go to the Dominican Republic to assess whether the United States should annex the Dominican Republic. Mm. And Andrew Dixon White took this trip to the Dominican Republic and came back to the U.S. and said, yes, the United States should annex the Dominican Republic. And so this summer, with a team of undergraduate students, we're going to get to look at Andrew Dixon White's diaries and archive that's located here at Cornell. And I think through that process, I'm excited to learn with the students about how he saw the Dominican Republic at that time. And as a way to think about, right, the United States' own role in imperial expansion, colonialism, and to think about the relationship with Latin America from here at Cornell.
Oh, wow. When will those results be available and where and in what form?
I don't know. TBD.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I like it. I like it. It's the carrot that dangles in front of our listeners. Excellent. Well, speaking of our listeners, where can they find out more about you, your book, and your work more generally?
You can find my book, Subjunctive Aesthetics, Mexican Cultural Production in the Era of Climate Change, on the Vanderbilt Press website. Or you can find more about my work on my personal website, carolynfornoff.wordpress.com. And to any Cornell listeners out there, I would love to see you in my classes about Latin American literature and environmental justice.
Carolyn, this has been fascinating, and we so appreciate you sharing what you've been working on. But before we sign off, we'd like to ask you to share a word in a language you speak, love, are learning, want to learn, that doesn't exist in English, but you wish it did. What word do you have for us?
Well, I am a chronic early riser.
Relatable.
Even if I go to bed late, sadly, I am awake with the sun. And so the word that came to mind for me was madrugar, or to rise early or rise with the sun, which is a word in Spanish, madrugar. It's a verb, which means to get up early. And I love the way in which it succinctly expresses this chronic condition of rising with the sun.
Nice. Not nice when you don't sleep enough, but
it's
I
true.
Like
it's
that notion.
It's a gift and a curse.
Yes, it is.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for speaking of language with us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Tune in next week to hear from Caroline Levine about poetry, translations, and the Norton Anthology of World Literature.
And speaking of poetry and translations, mark your calendars for our annual multilingual poetry event, Sweet Poetry, which will also take place next week on Wednesday, April 17th from 5 to 7 p.m. in the Klarman Atrium.
Until then,
auf Wiederhören.
The Language Resource Center is located on the ground floor of Stimson Hall on Cornell's main campus in Ithaca, New York. Check us out on the web at lrc.cornell.edu.
And follow Cornell LRC on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Speaking of Language is produced by Angelica Kramer and Sam Lupowitz.
Recorded by Sam Lupowitz.
Original music by Sam Lupowitz, Dan Gable, and Joe Gibson.
Thanks also to the College of Arts and Sciences at Cornell University.
As a reminder, the ideas and opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect those of the College of Arts and Sciences or any other official entity of Cornell University.
We thank our listeners, and do stay tuned for our next episode.